Well, thank you very much for your patience. I apologize for being late, but my plane was an hour and a half late this morning. I guess it's because of your weather. So I'll talk about the evolution problem in general relativity. So to start with, let me recall what are the Einstein equations. So the Einstein equation, which are the basic equations of general relativity, refer to, first of all, a space-time, 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time, a metric, which is a Lorentz metric, so it has signature minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. And typically, you also have some fields, phi, some matter fields. And the equations look like this. You have r mu nu minus a half g mu nu times r is equal to t mu nu, where r mu nu stands for the Ricci curvature of the metric. So this is, you take the Riemann curvature tensor and you take a trace, you get the Ricci curvature. This stands for the scalar curvature, which is a trace of the Ricci curvature. G is, of course, a metric, and T is an energy momentum tensor, which refers to these additional fields that you might have in the space-time. Right? And, of course, this part is a purely geometric part, and in particular, well, it satisfies all the geometric properties of usual of the curvature tensor in for a metric, and in particular, it satisfies the Bianchi identities. In fact, the twice contracted Bianchi identity simply means that the covariant derivative of r mu nu minus a half g mu nu r is equal to zero. This is equal to zero, and that of course forces d mu nu t mu nu is equal to zero, and this of course are nothing else but the conservation laws of the matter field. So this is one of the sort of remarkable features of the Einstein equation, that somehow the geometry dictates the conservation laws of the matter field. In any case, I'm going to restrict myself to the case where there is no matter field and look just at the so-called Einstein equations in vacuum, which are already sufficiently difficult. So I'm going to take t to be 0, and then the equation look like this. Simply r mu nu is equal to 0. You can see that by taking a trace. Since you have 0 here, if you take the trace of this equation, you get r equal to 0, and therefore r mu nu is equal to 0. So the equations are equivalent to just r mu nu equal to 0. The next thing that you want to do after you have your equations is to understand their character. So to start with, looks like you have 10 unknowns, which are the components of the metric, and 10 equations. But in reality, you have only 6 because of this, right? We know that d nu, r mu nu, is in fact equal to 0 because of this. And therefore, in reality, you have only 6 equations, so you have a system of equations which is undetermined to start with. And, this problem is solved by sort of interpreting a solution, as you should, as a class of equivalence of solutions. Namely, if I have a metric G, and if I look at a diffeomorphism phi from the manifold M to itself, and if I take the pullback or push forward of G, I'm going to get a new metric, which is, in fact, the old one written in different system of coordinates, you could interpret it. And there is no reason to distinguish between these two. These are the same. So if you take that into account, then you get a determined system of equations. So the important thing to recall here is that in the Einstein equations, really, a solution is, in fact, a class of equivalence of solution of metrics up to diffeomorphisms, right? Okay, the next thing you want to do is, now we know we have determined system of equations, and we want to look at their character. Are they elliptic, hyperbolic, parabolic? Clearly, these are PDEs. If you express r mu nu in terms of the metric, you get a complicated, obviously a very complicated nonlinear expression. And of course, you have to solve for the metric, so the equations you are going to get will be quasi-linear in the sense that the characteristics of the equations will depend heavily on the solution itself. Okay, so these are quasi-linear equations. And well, then you want to know, are they, well, obviously they should be hyperbolic because this is a relativistic system of equations. They have to be hyperbolic. But how do you see that they are hyperbolic? Well, if I just write down the equation in an arbitrary system of coordinates, I would not see it. The way to see the hyperbolicity is, again, to interpret the solutions in this way. That means that I have the freedom to pick a particular system of coordinates. Right? So relative to that freedom, the equations, in fact, become hyperbolic. Not only that, but there is a particular system of coordinates called wave coordinates. Wave coordinates. So these are coordinates x alpha on the manifold. So x alpha, this indices, Greek indices, run from 0, 1, 2, 3. Okay, so we have the Lambertian with respect to the metric of x alpha is equal to 0. So actually, you are solving your equation together with a coordinate, so-called coordinate condition. Okay, and once you do that, you express the Ricci curvature relative to these coordinates, and you find out that you get a system of equations which looks like this, g alpha beta d mu nu, g mu nu, d mu nu g alpha beta is equal to some nonlinear function of g and derivative of g. Right? So let's call it. So you get a system of equations in which the principal part you recognize as being a wave operator. This is essentially the wave operator applied to the metric. And on the right-hand side, you have a function depending on g and derivative of g. In fact, it's quadratic in the first derivative of g. Right? Okay, so that's how you see that the equations are hyperbolic. Okay, so there are many other ways of really writing down the equations. In fact, for many, many reasons, the wave coordinates are not that good, but they're sort of very useful numerically. For example, people like them because you get a very nice system of equations which has a clear character of a wave equation, therefore hyperbolic. But there are many, many other ways. So, for example, typically you really want to describe your equation as some in terms of evolution of relative to a time function. So what that means is that you introduce a time function, which I call t, and whose level hypersurfaces are space-like. So these are sigma t. These are the level hypersurfaces of sigma t. They are space-like, meaning that the normal is time-like. The normal, which I'm going to call t, is time-like. And then, obviously, the space-time metric induces a metric, which I'm going to call it here just gij, kij. So this refers now to space indices. So this is a restriction of the... So gij is just a restriction of the original space-time metric to sigma t, and k is a second fundamental form. Right? Okay. So k is a second fundamental form of the of sigma t viewed in our space-time. So, okay. And then, well, you find out that the gij satisfy... There is another... Well, the whole space-time metric, you might want to write it in the form minus phi squared dt squared plus gij dxi dxj. For example, you could write it like that. Phi, in that case, is called the Laplace function. So you have also an additional function, which is called the Laplace. And you get a system of evolution equation, which looks roughly like this, phi minus 1 dt of kij, of gij is kij, and the derivative of kij, phi minus 1, will have here the Ricci curvature, but this is the Ricci curvature of the, so this is a Ricci curvature of this induced metric on sigma t, right? And plus some other terms which are quadratic in K. Okay, so let me not write them down. Okay, the important thing is this looks almost like a wave equation because Rij contains second derivative of G as the principal term. But again, you have to be very careful. Written in if I take arbitrary system of coordinates on sigma t, the second order derivatives of Gij are not just Laplacian. So what you'd like to get here is Laplacian with respect to G of the metric Gij, and that's not true unless you make additional coordinate conditions on sigma t. So these are, for example, harmonic coordinates. Harmonic coordinates. So you specify additional coordinates. You have already a time coordinate, which is actually not specified yet. I still have the freedom to choose t in the right way. And of course, I can also specify additional coordinate conditions on sigma t. And these are specified by doing something very similar to what I have done in spacetime. I take this to be equal to 0, for example. So these are called harmonic coordinates. Right? And if you do that, you see that this becomes the principal term here, becomes really the Laplacian, and therefore you get here a wave equation for the Kij, for example. Okay? Right? This is very similar to what happens for the Maxwell equations. I recall the Maxwell equations. You have E and H, and you get evolution equations for E and H, which become you get derivative of E, you get derivative of H, and then from it you can derive a wave equation. And also similar to what happens for the Maxwell equation, you have constraint equations, right? So I'm talking about the Maxwell equations in vacuum for simplicity. So the constraint equations are simply di ei is equal to 0 equal to di hi equal to 0. So observe that this has nothing to do with the evolution in some sense. This could be imposed originally at time t equals 0 in your evolution, and then they will be satisfied at all later times. So we call this constraint equation. There are constraint equations here also, and so let me write constraint equations. And they look like this. You have equation for k, which is a divergence equation, dj of kij is equal to di trace chi. So this is a trace of the second fundamental form relative to the induced metric. Right? And then there is another equation which looks like this, the scalar curvature of this induced metric here. So these are equations on sigma t, right? The induced metric is equal to, so r minus k squared. Right, so this is the sum of the components of the second fundamental form squared plus trace of k squared is equal to 0. And as I said before, so these are constraint equations which, if they are satisfied at some original time 0, they will be satisfied at all later times, as it can be easily seen by looking at the evolution equation. Okay, in any case, as I also said before, that one can specify a coordinate condition for t. One can specify a condition for t. In other words, I have the right to choose. A typical thing that people do is to take trace k is constant or 0. Okay, so these are mean curvature. So this is a mean curvature condition. And this is called the maxima. So this is a mean curvature condition, and the foliation obtained by this condition is called the mean curvature foliation. And there is something similar. In this case, we call it a maximal foliation. Maximal foliation. This, of course, has something to do with minimal surface condition, right? But we call it maximal because of the signature change due to the minus one. Anyway, this is maximum foliation. Okay, there you go. So this is another formulation, and again the hyperbolic character comes up, provided that you really understand the importance of coordinates, right? Okay, now the next step, so once you understood this, the next step would be to really study the constraint equations. So the study of the constraint equations, maybe I'll write it here actually. So I'm not going to say much except maybe to point out some important steps in the development of mathematical theory of Einstein equations. The system of equation is highly non-trivial, right? And in fact, it really led to a lot of very interesting mathematics. There's been a lot of activity in the last 20 years in particular, but even before, starting with Lichnerowitz. So the first who solved this system was Lichnerowitz. But then there were some others like York, Choquet-Bruat, and others. And so by solving, I mean sort of finding a class, showing that there exists a class of initial data, a large class of initial data verifying these constraint equations. By the way, I should make a definition before anything else. Definition. An initial data set. So what an initial data set is a triplet, sigma, j, k, consisting of a three-dimensional manifold, sigma, and a Riemannian metric. By the way, I should point out that because of the fact that these hypersurfaces are space-like, right, the T is a time function, the induced metric is a Riemannian metric. The metric induced here is Riemannian. So we have sigma jk, g is Riemannian, so g is a Riemannian metric, and k is a two-tensor, a symmetric two-tensor, which would play the role of the second fundamental form. So this is an initial data set. And the development, or Cauchy development of an initial data set this is now something I start up with an arbitrary three-dimensional manifold, a Riemannian metric on it, right? And K, and I'm looking at the Cauchy development of it. So the Cauchy development of an initial data set is a solution of the Einstein equation, so it's a solution G mu nu, right? So this, if you want, I can use some other notations to make sure that I'm not talking about the same thing. So this is a space-time metric now, right, which satisfy the Einstein equation, so R mu nu, I'll put this equal to zero, right? And such that G and K become the first and second fundamental form, right? They induce first and second fundamental form. So in other words, if I want to be more careful, I should say together with an embedding, there exists also an embedding of sigma in this. So this is a manifold M, which is 3 plus 1. So there is an embedding of sigma into M such that I star of G and I star of K are the first, they induce first and second fundamental form of G mu nu on the image of sigma, right? Okay, so that's a very natural definition. Okay, so so this is a definition of the Cauchy problem. And the mathematical theory of the Einstein equation is, of course, nothing else but the study of solutions to this evolution problem, right? Okay? To study the character of solutions, singularities, and so on and so forth. I'll come back to this in a second. But let me say first a few words about the constraint equation, because this has generated a lot of mathematical, a lot of very beautiful mathematics. So the work of Lichnerowitz and York was just to find out somehow to be able to really write down initial data sets for the equations and to find out that there is a sufficiently large class of initial data sets. And as I said, this was done by Lichnerowitz-York, but there is still a lot of activity even today just concerning the study of the of solutions of the constraint equation. Then I might say here, if I talk about an initial data set, I'll make another definition which is useful. An initial data set sigma jk is said to be asymptotically flat if there exists a system of coordinates in sigma outside a sufficiently large compact set. I'm only interested what happens at infinity, right? Such that relative to these coordinates, gij, so if I express g relative to this coordinate, gij tends to delta ij, and kij tends to 0. Okay. Well, in reality, there is a mass term here. One has to be much more careful and say that this looks like 1 plus 2m over r delta ij plus low order terms of r to the minus 3 half, where r is nothing else but sum of xi squared, I running from 1 to 3 to the 1 half, where xi's are being exactly the coordinates I'm referring to here, okay, outside the sufficiently large compact set. So in reality, there is a non-trivial asymptotic. M plays a very, very important role. It's called the mass. And it turns out to be a quantity which is preserved by the Einstein evolution equations. So M is actually a conserved quantity. And there was a big problem to show that M is always positive, energy being positive. M is not only a conserved quantity, but it's supposed to refer to the total energy of the... Yeah, negative 3 half. I just put 3 half, but you can have other. I mean, you can have more precise asymptotic depending on the situation. But in any case, something that falls off faster than r to the minus 1. Okay, so. Well, that's what I'm going to say now. Okay, so there is a theorem which is called the positive mass theorem. Which is a theorem about this initial data set, right? And asymptotically flat initial data set that says that M is always positive, and M is zero if and only if the system here of initial data is actually flat. Okay, so the initial data set will actually be flat, namely G is in that case the Euclidean metric and K is zero, right? Okay, so that should be an answer to you. Okay, so that's a positive mass theorem, and there is another. Well, I'm only writing down the most interesting development. There is another. So this, of course, was done by Schoeniau and Witten, and later on by Witten with another proof. Okay, and more recently, the most interesting development relative to this initial data set was a solution of the Penrose conjecture. So this was the Penrose. I'm not going to say what it is because it would take me too much time. The Penrose conjecture. But this is something which was solved by Ilmanen and Huisken. Huisken and Ilmanen. And also, there was another proof given by Bray. But this proof used by Huisken and Ilmanen uses a very interesting flow, which is called the inverse mean curvature flow, which is now sort of being used in problems in geometry. So, and in fact, the positive mass theorem itself had sort of a big impact on the solution to the Amabe problem in differential geometry. So actually, there is a lot of interesting mathematics tied to these constraint equations, interesting geometry, differential geometry. Okay, but my goal here is not to talk about the initial data, but to talk about the evolution. So what can you say about evolution? So the problem of evolution. Okay, so here obviously I want to construct solutions. I want to construct Cauchy developments and find their properties. Right. So the first result, general result. in this regard was due to Choquet-Bruhat, Yvonne Choquet-Bruhat. In 1952, based in fact on theory of hyperbolic equations, not second order hyperbolic equations developed by Loret. Loret has provided the analytic framework, and she was able to prove using harmonic coordinates, using wave coordinates, therefore writing the systems of equations in this form. She was able to show that there are solutions to the equation, and in fact you get a solution for finite time. So she was able to construct local in time solutions. Right? So imagine that you have your initial data sigma, and you construct a development for some, and a time function, of course. But of course, the development is only you can assure the existence of the development only for a short time. And more precisely, there is a more precise result which was later obtained by Hugh Kato Marsden. So this is the most precise result in some sense, but the ideas are sort of quite similar in the proof. Which tells you what conditions on the initial data you need in order to produce a solution. And so let me tell you what they are. So you take in local coordinates, what you say is that there exists a system of coordinates again, right? And in those coordinates, G belongs to H5 half plus epsilon, or maybe I should say HS. So this is HS log on the initial data. So these are local HS spaces on sigma. So this belongs to, and of course G will have to belong to HS minus 1 log of sigma of the initial data. Sigma 0, I guess I called it. Right. And S has to be bigger than 5 over half. So this was the optimal result obtained by methods, which, well, I'll say a few words later on what kind of methods were used in doing this. Okay, so this was the local existence result. The local existence result was actually made by very soft techniques, was made into some kind of a global result, sort of global in quotes, because it's not really a global result that you should see, but Bruhat and Geroge were able to use this local existence result and prove the existence of the maximal future Cauchy development of an initial data set. Of course, an initial data set which has to be smooth. In fact, you need more. I mean, in their result, they need S bigger than 4 or something like that. But anyway, this is not too important at this point. I'll come back to it later on. But anyway, you prove the existence of a maximal future Cauchy development of any initial data set. You start up with any initial data. It's a very nice result. By maximal future development, Cauchy means simply that I write down the solution in terms of developed in terms of Cauchy hypersurfaces. These are called, space-like hypersurfaces sigma t, so in terms of a time function. And maximal simply means the same kind of maximality that you get in ordinary differential equations when you prove your local existence result. You prove first the local existence result, and then you take the maximum of all times for which you have existence, and that gives you the maximal, gives you in some sense a global result, because if you could prove that you have some a priori bounds, you get that immediately into a global result. But here, of course, it's slightly more complicated because of the geometry. But anyway, it can be done. So this is a maximal future development. And maximum future development, then it's sort of a nice tool to have in mind, because you could say then that the questions of understanding the evolution of initial data sets in general relativity becomes one of understanding the global property, the properties of this future Cauchy development, maximum future Cauchy development. Right? Okay, so you have one, and then you look at what you can say about it. Very much like you do in ordinary differential equations. You have your local existence result, which is maximal, because you maximize, and then you look at if you have any a priori bounds, you make it into a global result, and so on and so forth. Right, so this is the situation, and of course this is very primitive. Obviously we want to understand what happens for long time and large data and long time, and of course this is an incredibly difficult problem, in particular because you could have singularities. There is a very beautiful result due to Penrose, so there is a famous Penrose singularity result. Which tells you, well, first of all, we have a lot of, even before Penrose, there are many, many solutions, exact solutions of the Einstein equations, which exhibited singularities. And then the issue was, all these solutions, of course, were obtained under a lot of symmetry assumptions, because you cannot solve the equations in general. You make a symmetry assumptions, you get something. And then you wonder whether your symmetry assumptions were responsible for the singularities. And here he showed that that's not the case. So what he did was to show that if you have an initial data set with a trapped surface, trapped surface. So this is a very simple geometric condition, which is purely local. So it's very easy to implement. It's very easy to measure. And it's also a condition, I should say, which is, of course, very, very far away from what happens in Euclidean space. Right? It tells you that the geometry is very, very deformed. The geometry of the initial data set has to be already sort of very extreme. But if you have such a condition, which is simply to write down, then he was able to show that the maximal future development, the maximal future future Cauchy development is incomplete. Is geodesically incomplete. Therefore, something very bad must happen. Right? So, at the opposite end of this singularity result, there is a. So this is Penrose. At the opposite end, there is the stability, the global stability of the Minkowski space. Result obtained by Christodoulou and myself. Which says that on the contrary, if you have an initial data set, if you have an initial data set which is asymptotically flat, and which is small in the sense that relative to a system of coordinates, G is sufficiently close to the Euclidean metric and K is sufficiently close to zero, then the maximal future development is in fact complete. And not only complete, but it looks very much like the Minkowski space. But in fact, it looks, well, when I say it looks like a Minkowski space, I'm not quite fair. In reality, it looks more like the Schwarzschild solution than the Minkowski space at large distances from a compact set. But in any case, we still call it the stability of the Minkowski space because there are no singularities in particular. You get global solutions. So this is the situation where you get global solutions without any singularities, yes? Remains, of course, asymptotically flat, sure. So you start up with asymptotically flat initial data and you stay asymptotically flat. Right? So this is a sort of the opposite end. There's been recently some results of some simplifications in a sense of this proof, which is due to Niccolo and myself. It's going to come up soon as a book, actually, but it's shorter than the original book with Christodoulou. It's about 150 page shorter, so it should be an advantage. All right, so, but it doesn't really prove the whole thing, but it proves the main part of the stability, which is the solution of the problem of radiation, right, in general relativity. But I'm not going to say much more because I want to get to something else. So, okay, so this was the situation, and well, beyond that, it's very, very hard to do anything. There is a conjecture, there is a famous conjecture due to Penrose. Actually, two conjectures. These are called cosmic censorship conjectures. So these are supposed to be sort of the most interesting, the most desirable statements that you'd like to prove about the Einstein equations. And they tell you that somehow a general development of an initial data set might have singularities. In fact, you certainly expect to have singularities, but all the singularities are supposed to be not of a naked type, for example. They are supposed to be always covered by black holes and so on and so forth. Again, I don't want to get into this. I just want to say that this is a conjecture which is quite precise insofar as the structure of the singularity is concerned. Right? So it's a conjecture about the structure of the singularities. And obviously, it's extremely hard, and we don't have any idea how to prove this. Instead, people have looked at simplified problems. For example, I mean, there's been a lot of activity in general relativity of taking, again, solutions to symmetries. Right? You take a lot of symmetries so that your equations become much, much simpler, and then you can say something. Right? Okay, but so there is a vast literature about that, and in some situations you can say quite a lot. I mean, you can almost solve the cosmic censorship conjecture in certain situations, or you can even completely solve it. But of course, you pay in that your solutions are very, very special. So instead, I'm going to still talk about the general case. So I'm going to tell you about some recent developments concerning the general case. So I'm going to look back at this issue of local existence, and I'm going to sort of try to understand what is the optimal value of this coefficient S for which I have local existence. And in fact, I should point out that there is a critical exponent. There is a critical exponent, which I'm going to call SC, which turns out to be 3/2 for the Einstein equations, which is obtained in the following way. You take these norms, the HS norm, say, of G. Right? You look at the scaling properties of the Einstein equation. In fact, you see that G is essentially dimensionless, a dimensionless quantity. Right? And then you look at the values of S. I mean, I'm going to look at the homogeneous HS, just for simplicity. And I look at the value of S, so this is HS of sigma. I look at the value of S for which this norm is scale invariant. Right? Turns out to be 3/2. Now, so this is what I mean by the scaling exponent. And the conventional wisdom that we have in nonlinear equation is that anything below critical exponent is impossible. There is no well posidon whatsoever. And everything above the scaling exponent should be at least tried. It may be difficult to prove, but it should be tried. Now, I should point out that if you are able to get exactly to 3/2, right, so the issue is, what is the minimum S such that I have local well posidon S in HS? And I should say that this, it looks like it's still a local problem and might not be of interest, but in reality, if you get closer and closer to 3/2, the problem becomes global. So if you have a local existence in HS for S equal to S critical, you automatically have a global existence result. Right? So it's actually sort of a very powerful question, so to speak. Of course, what's interesting is this exponent. I mean, you'd like to get as close as possible to this exponent where things are happening. And there's another reason to look at this question. Somehow, again, conventional wisdom in nonlinear equations is that interesting things like blow up, singularity formations, and so on, happen at the scaling properties of the nonlinear equations. They have to be somehow coherent with the scaling properties of the nonlinear equations. And therefore, somehow, this is another reason why you like to get here. By the way, if you get here once again, you would prove a much stronger statement of the stability of the Minkowski space. By the way, if you get here, you could only prove the scaling exponent, you'll only be able to prove under an assumption that the norm, the corresponding norm, will have to be small. So you need a smallness condition. But of course, you have a smallness condition in stability of the Minkowski space. You'll prove a much stronger statement than the present stability of the Minkowski space, and one which will apply in many, many other situations. So these are sort of the motivations of why we are interested. There is another motivation which is more mathematical, which is that somehow in trying to get below the classical exponent, or the classical exponent, I'll call it classical, is 5/2 plus epsilon. Right? This is the one achieved by in the proof of Hugh Kato Minor. So by trying to get below this exponent, even a little bit, you are forced to really dig much, much deeper into both the analysis, which is used in understanding the Einstein equations, but also in the understanding of the Einstein equations itself, because I hope I'll convince you in a second that in order to get all the way to the critical exponent, you have to really use very, very special properties of the equation. Okay, so to convince you about that, let me... I don't know how much more time I have. Okay. Okay, so I don't have much, so I probably would... Okay, so I'll try to say as much as I can. So, okay. So, I want to understand this problem of existence, and let's look first at indeed at wave coordinates. So, if I look in wave coordinates, the Einstein equations look like this: g alpha beta d alpha d beta of g. So, g refers to all components of the metric, is equal to, again, a nonlinear term, which is g dg, like this. And in a first approximation, and remember that I said that this is quadratic in the first derivative, in a first approximation, it makes sense to really look at sort of a related problem, which will be that I take this one here, and I make it to be the Minkowski metric, and therefore, I get the standard wave operator applied to g is equal to f, or let me change the name so that you don't get confused, because obviously, I'm looking at a completely different equation. I look at the ambition of phi, which is a field, is f of phi and derivative of phi. And so let's study this issue of optimal well-posedness in the context of this kind of problems. And by the way, there are two models, more geometric models, which are of interest in that regard. One is wave maps. So these are equations which are obtained from a Lagrangian. And then another one, it's, say, Young-Mills. And they're slightly different. I'll tell you in a second. Right? So in fact, the wave maps schematically look like the ambition of phi. I'll write it very schematically. I'll just write it like this. Okay. So they are quadratic in the first derivative of phi. Right? And Young-Mills, again, very schematically, I'll write it like this. It's phi times derivative of phi. The scaling exponent, exactly the same kind of, making exactly the same kind of analysis, looking at the scaling properties of this equation, the scaling exponent here, well, so let's assume that I'm now in Rn plus 1. So this is the wave operator, the classical wave operator in n plus 1 dimensions. And the scaling exponent here, the critical exponent, is exactly n over 2. And here, the critical exponent is n minus 2 over 2. And Okay. Again, by using classic, you can look at the initial value problem. So you take phi of 0. Let me think of phi of 0. Let me write it like that. So phi of 0 denotes both data, phi evaluated at time t equals 0, and the time derivative of phi evaluated at the origin. Right? So this is the initial data. And just to make my notations easier, I'll say there is a classical local existence result, just like for the Einstein equation, which tells you that you can produce a solution for an interval of time 0 t cross Rn with t sufficiently small, provided that the initial data phi of 0 belongs to Hs, where S is larger than n over 2 plus 1 for, so let's call these equations of type 1, and let's call these equations of type 2. So for 1, and S bigger than n over 2 for 2. Okay? Of course, you do better for the Young-Mills because there are fewer derivatives. And so the issue was exactly the same. Can you do better? So the answer to this is yes, you can do better. And well, let me go very fast about the, I'll go in 2 seconds on the proof of local existence, classical local existence result for these equations. What you do is you establish a priori estimates for, let's say, this equation by looking at the HS norm. So you look at phi t, you look at the HS norm at fixed t, and you estimate that in terms of phi 0 in HS norm. And you have to put this term here, well, this term here, let me write it like that, d phi, this quadratic term, you have to put it in HS minus 1 norm and integrate from 0 to t. Okay, that's what you do. Okay? And, well, then you start distributing the derivative here. Anyway, if you do a little bit of paradifferential calculus, for example, it's not too hard to see that you can estimate this in terms of integral from 0 to t of first derivative of phi in L infinity and multiplied by phi in HS, so phi of t in HS. And therefore, by a Gronwall inequality, you get that the HS norm of phi evaluated at t is less than phi of 0 in the HS norm times an exponential of integral from 0 to t d phi in L infinity. Okay? So this is going very, very fast. And once you've done that, you see that somehow everything is okay. You can control HS norms of the initial data. You can control the evolution in HS norms, provided that you have control on this integral of the L infinity norm. But of course, the L infinity norm, what do you do with the L infinity norm? Classically, people didn't know what to do with the L infinity norm, and they bounded it by Sobolev inequalities in terms of, once again, in terms of H1, the Sobolev norm, plus, so let me call it S0, where S0 is larger than 1 plus n over 2. 1, of course, comes from here, and n over 2 comes from the Sobolev inequality, because you need to go from an infinity, you need to go to a Sobolev norm, right? So this is what you have here. So let me call it d tau here, d tau. Okay, once you do that, you see that you have the same norms. If S is larger now than S0, larger or equal to S0, you see that you have the same Sobolev norms on both sides. If I also take t to be small, it's very easy to see that you can bootstrap the norm and you get a good estimate. And then if you combine this with an iteration scheme, it's easy to prove a local existence result. But you see that you need t small. The smallness of t is required in order to control. Otherwise, this exponential term is, of course, huge. Right? Okay, so this is a classical scheme. And that's the one you see immediately that it gives you these results. But this is very crude. It's very, very crude, and you are using very little about the structure of the equation. So in recent years, we have tried to really understand this a lot deeper. And in particular, sort of the first observation that you can make is that here you have an integral norm. And it turns out that you can do much better by using an estimate, which has become very famous in recent years, which is called Strichart estimate. So Strichart inequality. This is an inequality for the standard wave operator. The standard wave operator in Rn plus 1. And the result is that integral from 0 to t of phi in L infinity squared, however, to the 1/2 is less or equal to phi 0. So this is the initial data. Maybe I should write it like that, phi 0 in h. So here I'm going to put n plus 1 over 2. Plus integral from 0 to t, and here you put f in hn minus 1 over 2. Right? So this is a Strichart inequality, which holds true, essentially holds true for n larger than 3. In fact, it has to be micro-localized to make it true, but anyway, I'm not going to get into that. So it's more or less true. However, in dimension 3, it fails, but in dimension 3, you need an epsilon here. Right? And then it will work. And then, of course, if you come here and now try to use, instead of using the silly Sobolev inequality, you try to use the Strichart inequality, you obviously are going to do much better. And in fact, that's how you gain half a derivative. So by using Strichart inequality, you see immediately that if you compare this to Sobolev, you have gained half a derivative. Right? The Sobolev will require n over 2 plus... Am I doing something wrong? I should have had d phi here. Right. So Sobolev will require n over 2 plus 1, and now you have n plus 1 over 2. So you gain half a derivative, which is not bad, right? And but then, of course, the issue is to try to prove this kind of Strichart inequalities. In particular, it's going to be quite difficult to prove the Strichart inequality for the Einstein equations. But that's another story, which I'll come, maybe if I have the time, I'll come up in a second. All right. So, okay, very good. So this is what we have. Now, you gain something. So instead of proving a result for s larger than the critical exponent plus 1, you prove now a result for critical exponent plus 1/2. So you gain half. But what about the other half? I still have to go to s critical, right? Okay. Well, it turns out, at least if dimension is equal to 3, that in general, you cannot do it. You can't do any better. There are some counterexamples, due, for example, to Hans Lindblad, that tells you that there is a gap. If I, in other words, if I look at this equation, the ambition of phi, say, let's for simplicity, just to give you something very concrete, dt phi squared. Okay, this is ill-posed in dimension 3. It's ill-posed below h2 plus epsilon. It's well-posed in h2 plus epsilon by Strichart, but it's going to be ill-posed. Okay, so what do you do? Well, it turns out that you have to take into account the structure, the deep structure of the equations, in order to do better. And this can be done by so-called bilinear estimate. So, well, first of all, you observe that if you look at the wave map equation, if you look carefully at wave maps, and you look carefully at Young-Mills equations, the nonlinear terms have special structure, which we call, we say that there is a null structure. And this null structure combined with so-called bilinear estimates allows you to do much better. And actually, the most remarkable thing that has happened recently, well, so in some work that I've done with Macedon and some other people, we are able to go, in many cases, we are able to go using this kind of method to go to S critical plus epsilon. I mean, S slightly larger than S critical, both for Young-Mills and for wave maps. And then there was a problem. Well, what about the critical case? I mean, this is, of course, the most interesting case. You want to go all the way to the critical case. And the most remarkable thing that has happened recently is that for wave maps, this was done. So in the case of wave maps to the sphere, when you go from Minkowski space, so wave maps are a system of equations specific system of equations, which looks very much like harmonic maps, except that you start with Minkowski space instead of starting with Euclidean space. So instead of starting with the Riemannian space, you start up with a Lorentzian metric. But let's take the flat case here, put a manifold here, and there is an energy integral whose critical points are solutions to the wave maps. Right? I'm not going to write it down, but it has a structure which is similar to 1, which I wrote there. Of course, it's much more complicated. Well, we were able to go all the way to the critical exponent, to as larger than as critical. Well, recently, Terry Tao, in the case of the sphere, was able to go all the way to, so for spheres, when m is sk minus 1, was able to go all the way to the critical exponent in all dimensions for every n large or equal to 2. And for the case of a hyperbolic manifold or for other type of manifolds, there was work by many people. There was my work with Rodniansky, then there was some work of Chatard, Struve, and also Uhlenbeck, and Nahmoud and Stepanov. That they were we were able, this collective effort went to n equal to 4, prove the critical case for n larger than 4. And then for lower dimensions, the lower dimensional case is much, much more difficult than the sphere case. This was done recently by my student, n equal to 3, was recently done by my student, Krieger. And he's also hoping to do, I think he's quite close to do also the dimension 2. For the particular case of the hyperbolic manifold, which is, by the way, the most interesting from the point of view of applications to general relativity. I'm not going to get into that, but that's the most interesting case. All right, so this is the situation for this this equation. But these equations, of course, and there is something similar happening, of course, with Young-Mills. The Young-Mills, the null structure is much more complicated. The bilinear estimates are a bit more complicated. But in any case, there is something similar. And again, in the case of, in the case of the Young-Mills equations, we can more or less go for any dimension n large or equal to 3. We can go more or less to as strictly larger than as critical. The critical case is still open, and it's a bit more complicated than the wave. If I go back to the Einstein equations, well, we like to do something similar for the Einstein equations, but of course it's infinitely harder. Because even to get the 1/2 gain that comes from the Strichert's estimate, you need now to prove Strichert's inequality. You cannot do it like this. I need to do it on a background metric. And this background metric, of course, has to remember the non-linearity. So if I start out with a non-linear equation, right, if my non-linear equation was, where did I write it? Here. You see, this depends on, right, this is the G itself. So let's think of it. It's easier if you think of it as a system of wave equations in phi. Imagine that you have a Lorentz metric which depends on phi. You have a phi here, and you have phi and derivatives of phi. So it looks like that. I can call these equations of type 3. These are the hardest. And you see that if phi is supposed to be just in HS, right, then this one cannot be any better than HS. Therefore, your metric is going to be extremely rough, very, very rough, in fact. Right? So you need to prove a Strichert inequality for very rough coefficients. Well, this is sort of a long story, which has been completed in a few number of steps. So the most recent results, let me mention, and then I'll finish. So there's been, for the actual case of the Einstein equations, Rodniansky and I proved in wave coordinates, show that indeed we were able to, one can go all the way to H2 plus epsilon, right? And that requires a lot of machinery, but more important than the analysis itself is that it really uses a lot of the Einstein equations. So, I mean, you really have to understand the fine structure of the Einstein equations. And there's been recently, and by the way, there's been also some work of Smith-Tataru in a slightly different setup. for nonlinear wave equations, which also give the same result. So it gives, in fact, a result also in higher dimensions and so on and so forth. But for three dimensions, it gives the same result. And there's also been some recent work of Anderson, Rodniansky, and myself, for not for wave coordinates, in which case you get the systems of wave equations, but rather for this mean curvature foliations, in which you get a system of wave equations coupled with elliptic equations. The structure is much more complicated, but they are better suited for all sorts of reasons. And of course, you get the same result, but in these other coordinates. And finally, I should say the most interesting case should be really to prove H2. I mean, H3 half is still much too complicated. It might not even be right, actually. I start to have doubts. And I have doubts because we have worked, Rodniansky and I have worked a lot on this H2 case. And I think we have, finally, we have sort of a general philosophy of how to do it. We have even implemented one major part, which I think is extremely interesting as far as the geometry of null characteristic hypersurfaces is concerned. And of course, to do that, you have to do something much deeper than Strichart inequality, because I told you Strichart inequality cannot do any better than H2 plus epsilon. So you have to use the bilinear structure. So if I told you before that in the proof of this result, you had to use the fine structure of the Einstein equations, here you have to use 1,000-fold the structure of the Einstein equation. I mean, here, this is absolutely essential because you need the bilinear structure. But unfortunately, I mean, I wanted to say a little bit more about characteristic hypersurfaces, but I guess I should stop here. So this is a good place.